Welcome to the newest feature of the DVD Marquee. I'm Jeffrey Rosato, and I'll be your solo host for this mini edition of the podcast. Now, if you're new to our show, my co-host Shane McDonald and I take in-depth looks at around 5 to 6 of the newest releases and forthcoming titles in every full-length DVD Marquee show. And since we're striving to keep our regular programs around the half-hour mark, there simply just isn't enough time to talk about every release that might tickle our fancy. So we came up with a couple of ideas. A companion blog to the show, which you can access by typing D as in digital, M as in marquee, E-Y-E, cravedvd.com/blog. It's also accessible for those of you that have the DVD Marquee page already bookmarked. Here, you'll find written reviews and capsule reviews of titles not discussed on our main show, and a mixture of hidden gems, cult classics, major releases, and warnings on those you might want to steer clear of. Secondly, the debut of mini podcasts, which we're dubbing Mini Marquees. Now, these will be occasional mini shows in which Shane or myself will put the spotlight on a very special film, box set, or series of titles under a unifying theme. Like, say, Fox's marquee musicals, season sets of popular or groundbreaking TV shows, multi-disc collections spotlighting a certain genre or performer, and so on. And to inaugurate our Mini Marquee series, I'm going to give you a lot of bang for your buck and make it worth your while. Over the weekend, I had a chance to check out the latest 3 releases in Fox Home Video's Film Noir series. Now, I have around half of the 15 that they've done so far, and I gotta tell you, I love them. From the insightful commentaries to flawless prints, they've done an incredible job so far. Now, the first of the 3 films that I want to talk about today is No Way Out. Now, it's not to be confused with the late 80s Kevin Costner flick with a twist ending that nobody saw coming. At least I didn't. This No Way Out is a 1950 drama that kind of stretches the boundaries of the genre a bit. No guys in 3-piece suits and brim hats buried in street corner shadows, no sexy femme fatales in distress, and no flunkies on the corner with inside tips. In fact, it's pretty much a socially conscious drama with some noir elements sprinkled in. Co-written and directed by the legendary Joseph L. Mankiewicz, its story centers around the struggle of Luther Brooks, a young black medical intern based in a hospital prison ward. And the actor assigned this challenging role? A very young Sidney Poitier in his very first film. And what a debut. But I'm gonna get more into that in just a bit, but back to the synopsis here. While handling nightside duty, 2 brothers shot while robbing a gas station are brought in, one on the verge of death and the other who wants nothing to do with this doctor just because of his color. Well, the way he says it uses language that I prefer not to repeat. Used to this kind of behavior, Luther shrugs it off and tries desperately to save the more seriously wounded sibling while his loudmouthed brother just continues raving. But that soon turns to rage as his brother dies. Accusing Brooks of murder and hurling non-stop racial slurs, it's not long before the chief resident of the hospital becomes involved, attempting to soothe the frayed nerves of both his superior and a very upset Luther, who wants an autopsy performed to not only ease his conscience, but to prove to the verbally abusive family member that he did all he could to save his brother. But the only way that's going to happen is for a next of kin to give permission for the procedure to be performed. Now let me tell you about some of the actors in the film, especially the guy that plays the racist supreme, Richard Widmark, a name that should be familiar to many a classic movie buff via his tough guy roles in a lot of films along these lines, and the kind whose brains weren't exactly built just right. And most of you, like me, remember that scene in his 1947 film debut Kiss of Death, where he pushes that crippled lady down a flight of stairs accompanied by that wicked laugh? Well, he surpasses his work in that film here. And the dialogue he has to deliver to Poitier along with spitting in his face, I mean, what courage it must have taken for an actor reportedly known to be one of Hollywood's good guys in real life to play such a despicable character. In fact, in Eddie Muller's terrific commentary track, he reveals that Widmark apologized after every such instance when the cameras stopped rolling. Now, in addition to the great performances by the leads, there's great work by Stephen McNally, who's super as the supportive chief resident in a role representing the type of American who didn't consider color an issue, a rare commodity at the time in which this film was made. I also have to mention the beautiful and talented Linda Darnell, who plays the wife of the dead brother that Brooks and Wharton have to track down for that vital autopsy. And although she was mostly known for her femme fatale parts, she's terrific as a conflicted soul trying to work her way out of a sordid past, only to have it come back to haunt her in an unexpected way. Now I'm going to talk more about Miss Darnell, who also plays a key role in our next movie on our mini marquee tray, but I have to mention two other legendary actors I want you to look out for during the course of this movie. Pay close attention around the 35 to 40 minute mark, and you'll spot an uncredited Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, two of the greatest film actors of our time playing members of the Brooks family. And even though they're just so impossibly young here, those unmistakable voices make you go, "Hey, is that Ozzie? And is that Ruby?" And Ruby was a babe back in those days, let me tell you. But unfortunately for the bachelors back then, these two had already been married for a while and would continue to be one of Hollywood's most successful marriages until his untimely death on February 4th, 2005. Despite its age, No Way Out is a compelling piece of dramatic entertainment thanks to a gripping, telling, and Oscar-nominated screenplay, along with a terrific integrated ensemble led by an amazingly confident Portier, whose performance has to rank as one of the best debut outings in film history. And I still can't believe it took nearly until the end of the 1950s with The Defiant Ones and beyond for him to achieve true stardom. He had the same kind of charisma, power, and class 56 years earlier. So if this is a Sidney Poitier film you've been avoiding due to its age or whatever, you owe it to yourself to check it out. It's a terrific movie. Now, the next release in the Fox Film Noir collection is a film that has gained a cult following over the years. Otto Preminger's Fallen Angel, the follow-up to what many consider a cinematic masterpiece, 1944's Laura. Dana Andrews, who became an overnight matinee idol thanks to that film, reunited with Otto to play down-on-his-luck press agent Eric Stanton, who winds up in a small California town and has his life complicated by two women, one being a sweet, somewhat wallflowery, and very, very rich lady named June. She's played by 20th Century Fox musical legend Alice Faye. The other woman, a vision in high heels, tight skirt with a smoky voice matching her attitude. Stella, portrayed by the undeservedly underappreciated Linda Darnell. Now, I told you we were going to talk more about her, and with good reason, for her role here has to rank in the top five femme fatales of all time, in my opinion. From the moment she walks into the local diner where she works as a waitress, she slithers in after a date, dressed to kill, with the biggest hat I've ever seen. And you know, I'm not really big on that kind of fashion accessory, but it's gotta be the sexiest damn hat I've ever seen. And if that's not enough, she sits down, takes off one of her shoes to massage an aching foot, and you can almost hear the sounds of a billion trampling male sets of feet waiting to line up behind Stanton to ask for a cup of Joe, or her phone number, or offer hand relief to her other foot, and some other things I could mention that might get us kicked off the air. No, wait a minute. Hang on. This is a podcast, but Mom and Pop, I'll keep it clean, okay? Now, upon its original release, Fallen Angel was considered somewhat of a flop for a number of reasons, mainly because many considered it highly inferior to Laura, but most of the blame fell on poor Alice Faye. Before the making of this film, Alice took off some time to raise her two children, and this was supposed to be her big comeback vehicle and a non-singing one at that. But critics and so-called loyal fans weren't kind, and she retired from the screen yet again and would only return sporadically for the remainder of her life. Matter of fact, I think she only did two to three more films, one of which was a 1960s remake of State Fair. But like I've said in the past, time can be kind to hidden gems like this, and that's certainly the case with Fallen Angel. Atmospheric, sexy, and compelling from its clever title sequence onward, it showcases the genre at its finest. Dana Andrews defines the tough yet vulnerable male a film noir has to possess to get its engine running. Linda Darnell is the femme fatale required to make it purr, and Alice Faye serves as a great counterbalance to help keep the proceedings between the lines. And I think it's a terrific performance, no matter what those so-called movie reviewers of yesteryear thought at the time. But the unsung heroes of this movie have got to be director Preminger and cinematographer Joseph Lachelle, who do things with a camera that were rare in movies at the time. long, painstakingly staged single shots ranging from following the actions of couples on a dance floor, getting as close as possible to a passionate kiss between Andrews and Darnell, and following actors from interior locations to exterior locales with no cuts. And you know, another thing I loved about Fallen Angel was its relentless pacing. Anytime it feels like it's dragging, it's fade to black time, next scene. I mean, it just keeps moving. Fans of classic cinema from this era will recognize other familiar faces, including Percy Kilbride, who later went on to fame as Paul Kettle in Universal Pictures' successful Ma and Pa Kettle series. Also, you've got veteran actor Bruce Cabot, who many will remember as Fay Wray's main squeeze in the original King Kong, and the versatile John Carradine, who's a real hoot in a brief role as a so-called mentalist. To sum this one up, if you're a true fan of film noir, you have to check out Fallen Angel. Okay, the last but kind of least is the weakest of this batch, but despite its flaws, is a fun, brisk, and watchable film from 1951, The House on Telegraph Hill. Perhaps the only film noir to commence in a Nazi concentration camp, Valentina Cortessa stars as our heroine, Victoria Kopwelska, who befriends a fellow female prisoner who hopes to one day reunite with her young son Chris in San Francisco. But that dream is short-lived as she dies soon thereafter. Eager to escape and begin life anew, Victoria assumes the identity of the dead woman, and luckily avoids the fate of so many of her camp members. After immigrating to New York, she meets Alan, Chris's devilishly handsome guardian, and his spinsterish housekeeper Margaret, played respectively by Richard Basehart and Faye Baker. Romance quickly blossoms between Vic and Alan, with wedding bells ringing soon thereafter. Then, it's off to settle in San Fran in a gothic-looking mansion atop the city's Telegraph Hill. A charming hubby, a precocious son, an efficient servant, life is more sweeter than even the woman whose identity she's assumed could have ever dreamed of. Until one dark and stormy night. Hey, I have to throw in a cliche here, you know. Anyway, it's a stormy night, and Victoria can't sleep. So she goes downstairs, only to discover Margaret looking more like Jane Greer in Out of the Past, with Alan not far behind. Now, what could be happening with these two? Then, after cheating death on two near-miss occasions, Vic wonders if Alan's all that he's cracked up to be, or is she going wacky, or will she live to find out the truth? And most importantly, will she learn the value of having your brakes inspected annually? Hey, you can even have it done when you have your oil changed. Okay. You may suspect by my tone that I've found The House on Telegraph Hill to be a silly exercise in film noir crossed with a woman facing insurmountable odds potboiler, and I did have a few problems with it. For one, Basehart just doesn't project enough menace to come across as the pretty face hides evil mind type. In fact, Eddie Muller's commentary mentions a short list of actors that were originally offered the part, including Dana Andrews and Richard Widmark, who could have acted rings around the likable but ultimately bland Basehart. My pick, had he lived, the great Robert Walker, who played that brilliant psychopath in Strangers on a Train. I mean, he would have cleaned house with a part like this to chew on. Then, there's the laughable, outrageously over-the-top musical score by Saul Kaplan that telegraphs, pun unintentional, kiddies, anyway, that telegraphs every plot point just in case we can't figure it out for ourselves, you know? Anyway, yet and still, veteran director Robert Wise manages to bypass these miscues with brisk pacing, effective yet moody cinematography, and an appealing performance from Cortessa. Despite the Italian-bred actress's spotty command of English, her effortless charm and film-ready beauty that bring comparisons to the likes of Greer Garson and Ingrid Bergman help make this easy to get through. It's no classic, but with some great set pieces and a quick running time of 93 minutes, The House on Telegraph Hill is a somewhat enjoyable and occasionally exciting film that should satisfy most film noir faithful. But for those just getting into the style of the cinema, are best advised to rent this one. And please, do make sure your brakes are in good shape before heading out to your local video store. You'll thank me for it. Finally, let's talk about the extras. Every one of these three releases has an original trailer, publicity and poster artwork photo galleries, some have location and candid shots, and there's one that has some brief movie-tone news clips. I think that's on the No Way Out disc. But the best thing about all three are commentary tracks by the way too knowledgeable and highly listenable Eddie Muller, film noir expert bar none. He's a well-known author who's written many books on the cinematic art form, and if I remember correctly, he's also the head honcho of the Film Noir Foundation, which specializes on rescuing noir films that are in danger of being lost. And if you'd like more information on how you can help, I'm sure he'd appreciate it if you'd pay a visit to the organization's website at www.filmnoirfoundation.org. Again, that's www.filmnoirfoundation.org. But back to these commentary tracks before we have to wrap things up here. Mr. Muller has evidently done his homework over the years. From the back history of many of the participants in front of and behind the lens, to information from studio documents, his knowledge of filmmaking techniques, and even a droll joke or two, it's like spending time with the coolest film professor on campus. All three commentaries are great, but if I had to pick a favorite, it has to be Fallen Angel, where Muller is joined by Susan Andrews, daughter of the acting legend Dana Andrews, and she reveals a lot of cool details about her dad, from the importance of walking straight with posture, I take it people who slouch didn't appeal to him, and that he loved to sing opera around the house. I just love learning new factoids and trivia like that. It's great, as if my brain's not stuffed enough with useless knowledge. But maybe if they ever come up with a movie-themed spinoff of Jeopardy. Anyway, there you go. The latest three releases from Fox Home Video's Fox Film Noir series. And as far as star ratings for each film, I'd give Fallen Angel and No Way Out 4 stars out of 5. And I'll be generous and give 3 stars to The House on Telegraph Hill because I really enjoyed Valentina Cortessa's performance a lot. Not to mention her 30 costume changes. Until we meet again, remember, you can hear both our mini marquee and regular half-hour DVD marquee shows at, well, let me make it a little easier on myself and you this time. Just type in D as in digital, M as in marquee, dot E-Y-E as in iCraveDVD.com, and make sure you pay a visit to our brand new companion blog. All you gotta do is type in that same information I just gave you, add a /, and the word blog for additional reviews, commentary, and the latest on the show. Special thanks to our friends at both iCrave DVD and the Home Theater Forum for their generous ongoing support. Until next time, for Shane McDonald and all of us at the DVD Marquee, thanks for listening. And hold the butter, but give me just a pinch of salt with that popcorn, okay? Okay.